This is URN.
The Film Show Breakdown.
Hello everyone, welcome back to The Film Show, our second edition of what I called last week Home Theatre, as we're not in the studio right now, are we guys?
Nope.
To put it simply, we are still in isolation and we've brought some suggestions of some good entertainment, some good factual entertainment to tide over the boredom. We've brought a variety of documentaries and we're going to jump right into it. And we're going to start off with Diego Maradona. Joseph, tell us about it.
Yeah. So Diego Maradona tells the story of the legendary footballer, Diego Armando Maradona. And it starts off as he finishes his time at Barcelona. He spent 2 years playing for Barcelona, the most expensive footballer in the world, but he couldn't finish either of the seasons due to injuries. And the injuries added to the high wages he was on and the high transfer fee that he would require means that he pretty much no one could buy him. This is 1984. So out of nowhere, he goes and signs for SSC Napoli. This was a time when a lot of major footballers were going to Serie A, but they were going to the likes of Juventus, Inter Milan and AC Milan, and not Napoli, which was, I think Naples was like the poorest city in Italy at the time. It was one of the poorest clubs. They were mid-table and they suddenly signed the most expensive footballer in the world in Maradona. And suddenly their success just booms. They become massive. They become champions of Serie A, all thanks to Diego Maradona, who has become like a godlike figure. And we see his rise and fall in the hearts of the people of Naples.
What do you mean by rise and fall?
So basically, he's seen as like a god-type figure in Naples due to the sheer impact he's had on the team. But through different things, events happening through his personal life, as shown in the documentary, towards about him having a secret child with a different woman, his drug problem, which is what he's probably best known for nowadays, unfortunately, and during the 1990 World Cup in particular, which has a brilliant scene. It was made for a film. The scene that happens in the 1990 World Cup, in which Maradona is playing for Argentina, he comes up against Italy in Naples for the semi-final of the World Cup, and basically Maradona was asking the people of Naples to support Argentina rather than support Italy, which basically soon made him, as Argentina went through to the final. That's not a spoiler, it's football history. Yeah. that made him suddenly the most hated person in Italy.
Like, it doesn't seem real. It's like it's almost like they made it up, but it's not.
Joining us is Isaac. Sorry, go on, Isaac.
Yeah, but glad to be back, people.
We've missed you for the past couple of weeks. How are you?
Stop it. I'm all right. I'm fine and healthy.
You love to hear it. What were you saying about the World Cup, Isaac?
Oh, that in the you just because it's so dramatic and so integral to this story, you actually think it's fake or highly exaggerated. But like if you even do some basic reading about it, it's true. Like everything it does, it's just it doesn't, you know, overblow it.
And the thing is, it's not like a straight football film. Like, it has so many elements. It has the gangster film elements, it has the personal elements, and it has this really strong idea about the toll of celebrity, how people deal with being put above just being a human being treated as a godlike figure. There's this really interesting thing that Maradona's personal trainer says in the film, where he's distinguishing the young man trying to be a footballer, Diego, and this sort of personality that he's created for himself called Maradona, that he dealt with so he can deal with the press and the media and all this scrutiny and stuff. And he said, with Diego, I would walk to the end of the earth, and with Maradona, I wouldn't take a single step.
Oh, so you see, I saw that line. I remember seeing a trailer for the film, and I saw that line, and that struck me really hard.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting because it really fits in well with the trilogy that Asif Kapadia, the director, has managed to create with Senna and with Amy in regards to celebrity culture that I don't think is talked about much with.
Do you want to talk a little bit about his previous films, what they're about?
Yeah, so Senna is about Ayrton Senna, the Formula One driver who tragically passed away at the age of 34 after winning three Formula One titles. And the second one is his most acclaimed film. It's the highest grossing documentary of all time. It's Amy, about Amy Winehouse,
yeah,
who also tragically passed away in 2011. And was pretty much misunderstood from the get-go, demonized by media,
yeah,
and having her own trouble with drug abuse and stuff. But the difference is here, is that why I think it's Capaldi's most complete work is that it's all about the creative decisions that he makes the documentary success.
So I'm somebody who's not as big as a football fan, I'm guessing, as you are, Joseph. So,
no,
you know, when with someone like, you know, Diego Maradona, like, I know, you know, some basics, you know, like, I do, a lot of people consider him a great footballer. He had drug problems. You know, there was the infamous Hand of God goal.
You know the Hand of God, and you know the shot in the 94 World Cup of him running towards the...
That sounds familiar. Remind me what happened. I think I do know about the Hand of God.
So the England match in 1986. So the 86 World Cup is very important in the sort of narrative of the film because it was so important in Maradona's career. It's what it's known for the most. It's the Maradona World Cup.
Yeah.
It, against England, he's running through on goal and he goes and punches the ball over Peter Shilton and goes into the goal. And he says after the game, it wasn't my hand, it was the Hand of God that did it. And then like 5 or 10 minutes later, he goes on to score one of the greatest goals ever seen, running, sprinting past six players and putting it into the bottom corner sort of thing. So it shows the genius and the cheating side of Maradona, how he's seen as both a hero and a villain.
But that's what I love,
What I love about this documentary is that I don't have to be a massive fan of football or knowledgeable about the man himself, but it's just so, just the way it's constructed. And I kind of like documentaries, like possibly one I'm going to mention later, in that there's no talking heads, if that makes sense. There's no...
There's no one-on-one interview, just to clarify.
Like, there's narration from various people and Maradona himself, but primarily it's the footage that tells the story.
It's the footage and it's the sound as well, which is very impressive.
Yeah, especially with like major football matches, like you really do feel, even on my, you know, on my laptop, like, you can really feel like the tens of thousands of people in a stadium.
Yeah.
And yeah, how it's constructed, because it shows you, like, it plants little things that, you know, the plants, like, why he rose so high, but then the plants what makes him fall so hard as well.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost interesting Shakespearean.
Because there's so much footage. They found over 500 hours of footage because Maradona had his own personal camera crew. They had people shooting specifically him in the matches, which makes really good cinematic use. I mean, football's always struggled to be shown on the big screen because you're following so many different players, there's so many things that didn't happen, but because they had shots specifically of him throughout it makes him really
almost like made to have a documentary made about him. It's so perfectly constructed.
But the thing is that there's so many directions you can go in with telling his story, that there's so many things I didn't even touch on, like the 94 World Cup, when he got kicked out for doping, him being the manager of Argentina in 2010 after overcoming all these problems, his appearance at the 2018 World Cup, which is so iconic, which they show briefly at the end. But just to focus on even before that, about his rise and going to Barcelona and things like that, but to focus solely on his time in Naples, which I think is really important because of it shows the impact that he had on the average person much football meant to them.
I think that's a really good decision that they predominantly focused on him in Naples. You know, you could tell so much about before and after. Like, that is such a key moment in his career and his life.
Yeah, and you see the vibrancy of the 1980s. To have it set over a specific decade rather than spanning multiple decades, you get a real vibrancy to it.
Yeah, like in the beginning when he's being driven to the Naples Stadium and there's this kind of very thumping sort of synth-driven electronic score, which I think was a really good usage of that music.
Yeah.
So it's a 2-hour, 10-minute documentary. And even then, it's of course not going to be enough to cover the vast history of his.
No.
Does it make good use of the time?
I think so. I don't think it's boring at any point or anything. It's a hard thing to balance, because for people that like football, they want more football. People that don't like football, they want less football. Yeah. They want to know more about his personal life. So it's a very hard thing to balance, but I think it balances it quite well. You have sort of like an even split of what you need, and only shows what's sort of necessary.
Well, people are fascinated with celebrities, so I think that's one thing that's going to draw people to the documentary. Yeah.
There's some bits that are quite confusing in terms of if you don't know too much about the drug scene in Italy at the time.
What do you
mean? So because it's quite like gangster based in some respects, and talking about how they got the money to fund Maradona's transfer, about the situations he got into which led to his ultimate demise as a footballer with his drug issues. If you don't know that kind of stuff beforehand, then it becomes sort of like quite difficult to follow in some respects, but because of its intimacy in terms of understanding Maradona as a person, both on the pitch and off the pitch, then it sort of makes it all right, makes it work.
I would say one major criticism I have of the film is less to do with the, it's not a detriment to the film at all. I think it's just because of the nature of the archives. Like, there's a lot of archive footage which is video based or videotape, and there's stuff which, you know, makes up a lot of the news coverage and all sorts of things. And obviously, due to the limitations of that format, like, stuff can look very kind of, I don't know, the quality isn't very good.
Yeah, but that's not no fault of the director. No, he can just work with what he's got.
If anything, I think that can sometimes add a charm to a documentary if you have the different quality of footage.
Yeah, especially as the home video looks similar to the way that it's done on the pitch because of the personal photographers for Maradona.
But that's interesting, because again, that's just that's not really a criticism, it's just personal preference. But I think, you were saying earlier about, like, the contrast, you know, because a lot of the video is also like home footage and home movies, but then you have some footage of like the footage that's obviously shot on, you know, like 35 or 16 millimeter, like it is of the stadium, it is of the match, so you kind of feel this vast scope. Like, I haven't really, even on my like little laptop, it's like you can rarely have I seen like a football match, like, you know, on that scale before,
yeah,
you know, because we really think
of it. But it works though to an extent, because they look I've seen a lot of football documentaries in the sense of that they often follow a season, and you have things off the pitch, and then suddenly on the pitch it looks completely different to everything else, and it looks separate and it feels separate, and you know, you can fall into just your standard documentary then, and like your
TV.
What
do you consider to be
thing.
Like a standard documentary? Because we're going to be talking a lot about
ones that are made for like Sky Sports or on BBC. Yeah. I remember watching a documentary about George Best that sort of like made it very separate between the play that you saw on the pitch and the personal life that they're talking about. A lot of especially football documentaries are about like a genius of a player. So if you were to make this film about someone like in the modern era, like Messi, it would be very different to how you make a film like this, because it's a very controversial figure and the footage is going to be very different. I mean, if you've got it with a modern footballer, you're going to go out and you're going to shoot footage of them playing now, and you're going to make footage specifically.
It's going to be a bit more like,
if you're using what you've already got, then it's different.
It's going to be a bit more manufactured, and it's going to be more positive towards them, because they'll have more say in it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, Kapadia did meet Maradona several times. Yeah. In the making of the film, but it's sort of like he's like, edit the section, then he'll go and meet Maradona, edit a section, go and meet Maradona. So it's sort of like, so he's sort of following the narrative as he's learning it.
So using it as a guideline.
Yeah, because what's always been said about someone like Maradona is that it's been incredibly difficult to make stuff about him, because, like they said, if you publish a book on him, as soon as you get it published, you'll find out that he's just gone and done something, else. It's someone that you can't keep up with. You know, making a documentary on someone that's still alive as well is very, makes it stand out from being like Senna and Amy, which
you
has a very obvious conclusion.
You can almost do like a documentary series on it.
Yeah, for sure.
We might talk a bit more about that later. I think it's pretty much time for us to give our final thoughts.
Yeah.
We'll start with Isaac, because Isaac is You're not as interested in the football side of it, I believe. Is that right, Isaac?
No, I'm obviously not as, you know, I'm not a massive football fan in like contrast to my family and others. But I've really enjoyed watching this documentary because it got a good glimpse into someone who I had a vague idea or, you know, a vague idea of who someone, sorry, my words, a vague idea of somebody who I knew. Again, kind of this, you know, this kind of like stereotype of Maradona rather than, you know, him as a person.
Yeah.
And it really did engross me in not just, you know, the man himself and his rise and fall, but sort of the world that surrounds him, like both the football, the culture of football during, you know, the 80s and the early 90s, but, you know, the Italian mafia, the Italian public, the city of Naples. Like, it really engrosses you in with the mixture of, like, you know, lots of great archival footage and its sound design, particularly in major matches. So even if you're not a massive fan of football or not interested initially about Maradona, I highly recommend the documentary and obviously the director's other films.
Perfect, Joseph.
Yep. I really like this film. It was one of my favourite documentaries of last year. It's the kind of film that I would personally choose to watch in my own time while other people wouldn't. But I do think it is worth taking a chance on if you're not put off by the subtitles and stuff, which I know that some people are. I think you should check it out regardless. It has a lot of important things to say. It has a lot of interesting ideas and it goes in directions that you didn't think it would. And would take someone of the skill of someone like Asif Kapadia to try and work out the best way to do it. And I think he pulls it off with some aplomb.
All right, perfect. Thank you. I definitely need to check it out myself at some point.
This is University Radio Nottingham.
Now we're going to be discussing from one of the most controversial figures in pop culture to one of the least, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
It's a tenuous link. I think a link nonetheless. We are talking about Won't You Be My Neighbour, the Mr. Rogers documentary. I think we have all seen, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Isaac, do you want to tell us a little bit about what the documentary covers?
Oh, where do we start? Well, Won't You Be My Neighbour is a 2018 documentary about the life and career of Fred Rogers, who was known for his show Mr. Rogers' Neighbourhood, a children's programme where him, a few other people and a series of characters sort of, you know, give sort of general universal life lessons aimed at children. You know, it goes from sort of his early childhood right to the end of his career.
Sort of goes from his early childhood. He does this very interesting thing where he uses an animation of the Daniel puppet to represent how Mr. Rogers felt as a child. It's definitely not...
I think that's the idea sort of thing. So Mr. Rogers becomes the different characters that he creates as he ages.
This is sort of the end of a saga which started with the Tom Hanks special, and then the week after we did the Tom Hanks film about Mr. Rogers, and now we've linked that background to the Mr. Rogers documentary. Now the interesting thing is the Tom Hanks film was very much a slice of Mr. Rogers' life.
Yeah, he was a supporting character in that film.
Yeah, it was all about
his influence, the impact that he had on a different person in that film played by Matthew Rhys. This is very much about him. Yeah. So I think you should watch the A Beautiful Day Neighborhood, the Tom Hanks film first before you watch this. Because I feel like this film was made for people that knew Mr. Rogers more than the other film was.
And sorry, go on, Isaac.
I actually kind of disagree because I didn't know much about Mr. Rogers prior to the documentary and the Tom Hanks film, and I watched it in reverse. Even though I agree with you that it's the better thing is to watch A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood first.
Yeah,
like I thought
because it's a bit more mainstream.
Yeah, and I think it's good to be introduced to the character through the skepticism of Matthew Rhys's character because it sort of peels that away for you.
Because it's sort of the theme of, or just the question that's always been asked about Mr. Rogers is like, is this guy for real?
Yeah.
sort of thing. And that's sort of a question brought up in the documentary, and you get a better understanding of that answer, but you don't really get a clear answer in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. It's up to you. Sort of.
I find it kind of interesting, Mr. Rogers as a character and as a phenomenon, because, you know, you, Joseph, and you, Jamie, now know who he is. Like, yeah. He's a massive icon in the United States, but in somewhere like Britain, he's, you know, I don't think he's that well known.
I only knew about him through American media, and it's sort of like cultural osmosis almost. So I knew him as this icon, this iconography that was parodied or whatever. I didn't know much about what he was famous for or what he actually was like as a presenter or as a person. So watching these two different types of mediums which explore him as a character,
it feels like it wouldn't really work in this country because of the cynical nature of the British.
What I love about the documentary, because just to say up front, I adore this documentary, is that even though we think of Mr. Rogers more as a national icon, I think, you know, the excerpts of him being interviewed or his program, even if it's, you know, episodes from decades prior, there is kind of a universality and a timelessness which I think is quite phenomenal. Like,
he's teaching.
Like, there's a really amazing clip in in the documentary where, you know, him as Daniel talks to one of the presenters and asks what assassination is. And this is very shortly after, you know, Robert Kennedy's assassination in 1968. And, you know,
isn't that John F. Kennedy's?
Was it JFK, not Bobby?
Yeah. It was Bobby's.
Was it?
Because they had that train that was going past people, and someone held up the sign that said something like, we'll miss you, Bobby.
Okay. Yeah,
so it was, and just even for the late 60s, like, it's just kind of phenomenal that our children's program for all ages can deal with such serious subject matter, but not even in a political stuff, but also like more, you know, what domestic stuff. Like, he talks about things like divorce and, you know,
that came later in the, that's sort of like the way they present it in the documentary, at least, is that came later on. That was when he returned and he started tackling bigger themes on like a broader scope, like every week. And divorce was one of them. And I thought it was a very interesting way of doing it. So he's been, I don't want to say criticized, well, sort of criticized. He's been questioned a lot about why he took a few years break and then came back. Like, in the film, Matthew Rhys was asking him, oh, was it just for the money? Like, was your career not doing as well? And the documentary suggests the idea that he thought he'd covered everything that needed to be covered, but then just stuff kept happening and piling on. And he realised he hadn't done it, or he thought he hadn't done enough.
And knows that he can make an impact on people's lives and help them understand these kind of situations. And becoming a parent, you learn more things about what children need over time as well.
I think also one of the great things about the documentary is its perspective on Mr. Rogers, because even though we sort of see him as a very good person and, you know, very, very understandably, like, it does show there are scenes where it's less, you know, him doing something bad, but, you know, it doesn't make Mr. Rogers out to be a saint. You know, he is just
person. I said earlier that Mr. Rogers was one of the least controversial figures, but I guess that's not saying much in the world of celebrity. But it's interesting because it's not that he never had controversies or he never had issues. It's that, for the most part, they were sort of elaborate. Like, they were sort of sensationalized, at least in one of the senses that he had the controversy where the news was saying, like, oh, Mr. Rogers is teaching people that they don't have to work to be special. They were born special, and he's made people narcissistic, which is absurd.
It seems fake, because it was, wasn't it, Fox, the Fox News excerpt?
Something like that, later. I think, it seemed
I think it was Fox News, and it just, and, you know, that stuff like that is absurd. But then one of my other favorite moments in the documentary is when his crew, there's like one of them takes a photo of them mooning on set and they think it's very funny. And then during Christmas of that year, Mr. Rogers, like, give their present is like a giant blow up of that image.
I think even Mr. Rogers, McFeely's actor.
Yeah, I think it was him. And it showed that Mr. Rogers, even though he, you know, his sense of humor or just his personality was very, you know, like, for all ages, he did have, you know, he did have a sense of humor that was his own. Because and that made me chuckle.
I was surprised to learn about the pranks on set, because you'd think that it would be like a very delicate atmosphere. But they were pulling pranks on him quite frequently, and he sort of loved it. Like, there's a bit at the end when they're doing the final episode and he goes to open the cupboard and one of the crew is like waiting for him and says, "Oh, you're being evicted, you have 2 days to leave." It's that sort of like sporting pranks that weren't meant to offend him, like he could laugh along with it.
I think also what's great about documentary, and again in the excerpts they show, is that the actual show itself, like, even though it was, you know, for all ages, there is somewhat of a surrealist quality to it. I don't know if that's just me. Like,
that's something
that's
definitely picked up more in the film,
yeah,
rather than the documentary.
Yeah, but maybe it's,
it could be like a dreamlike kind of thing about it.
It's like, it seems like something that like Adult Swim would do, you know, nowadays. Like, it was like almost like, you know, something that, you know, it's like the Eric Andre show, but without, you know, the adult humor. And I think, as someone, the documentary engrosses you in the show, because it's like, even though the show is obviously for children and, you know, for all ages, like, I'm interested in it. I actually want to watch episodes of it, even though I'm not its target demographic.
Well, it was appropriate. He wanted it to be appropriate for all ages, at least. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask a bit about, I don't know if this is where you were leading to earlier, Isaac, but there was a bit where the Officer Clemens actor was talking about how Mr. Rogers found out that Officer Clemens was gay. And he was saying to him, "Oh, you know, you can't keep going to this bar, and you can't come out on you can't come out." And I was wondering, where is this going? Because Mr. Rogers has been displayed as nothing but tolerant. And he made this very interesting, like, he talked about how he was afraid that the sponsors and like a lot of the public wouldn't like it.
I think that's a very interesting segment in the film, because with Officer Clemens, it's like, I think how the documentary presents it is that Mr. Rogers didn't have a problem with his sexuality, but I think Mr. Rogers, for better or worse, kind of understood, you know, that someone, like, especially in that time, I think in this, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s. That,
70s, definitely.
Yeah, that, you know, that the world wasn't as open as he was in regards to that.
Yeah.
So if he was not just, you know, openly gay, you know, as the actor, but let's say on the show, I think as much as it would be horrible if that were the case, the sponsors, I think, would pull out because the world hadn't, you know, been progressive enough to deal with such things.
Mr. Rogers wasn't afraid to make a political statement. Like, with Officer Clemens himself, he had the famous, like, sharing the paddling pool.
Yeah, yeah.
For him,
that's very important.
His speech at Congress to about PBS.
That was actually beautiful. Like, because I remember, I've watched that clip before I even fully understood who Mr. Rogers was, of him, like, winning over the really, like, cynical judge. You could make a film about this, about that hearing itself.
Yeah.
About trying to get PBS more money.
And I think that's really important because, again, PBS is public broadcasting. It's public broadcasting, you know, similar to the BBC. And, you know, even though it's, you know, PBS is an American company, what he was saying in that speech is quite universal. And I think important for stuff like, you know, public broadcasting like PBS or the BBC to have, you know, let's say, educational program, you know, the old BBC mantra of, you know, to inform, educate and entertain. I think something like children's television, even though I don't watch it anymore, of course, I think it is important for it to be, you know, maybe less biased in the sense of, you know, for it to sell something for commercial purposes, not to sell in terms of morals or ethics, but to sell products, you know, which can be very easy in children's television. Like, if you watch like a children's channel and then you just see that all the adverts are just, you know, toys, you know.
It's about IP extension so much these days. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like something that isn't just all bright colours and stuff, and you can actually has a purpose to it, I feel like. Makes this such an important kind of show because it stands out as being different to anything else as well.
The purpose of the show was like so important to him as well. He was saying how he was frustrated with people just being taught to be great consumers when they're older. I think that was really poignant as well, because he wants people to see value in themselves without having to do that, or without having to be without having to do anything sensational. to be treated like the sensational, or to be loved for like who they are. And if he knew that was such an important message, especially in like child development, he had a background in child psychology. I didn't know about, and it was really interesting to learn about that. Like, how do you think, in the way he's presented in that sense, how do you think it compares to the film? Because the film, because it's a supporting character, we don't get as much backstory about him, and we're just kind of seeing through the eyes of one person, which does a better job of presenting his ideology, let's say.
I think the film does, the Tom Hanks film.
Really?
Because you sort of see, yeah, I do personally, because of, you see the impact that he can have on all people of all generations, how we can sort of like bring people together with just being like a good person and passing off those kind of morals, not telling someone how they should act, but also, you know, just seeing how the influence, having a positive influence on someone else can create resolutions to problems.
He did try and do a show for adults for a time, we learned in the documentary. Do you remember what it was called? Old Friends, New Friends, that's it. But he found like he wasn't able to connect in the same way. I think what the film says is, like, you don't have to do that through a big TV program. You don't have to do Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood for Adults. You can connect people on an individual level.
Yeah, that's about, you know, how he cared more about the person that was interviewing them than the actual interview itself. Yeah.
Like, and I feel like
from that you can understand more about the person that way.
He saw the journalists as like a, almost like a challenge, like they would challenge each other. We talked about the other week.
Yeah.
So what do you think?
And I do feel it does have some of the ideas that are shown in the documentary as shown in the film in different ways. And I feel like just the film's more creative in the way that it tells the story.
Definitely worth watching both. So let's give our final thoughts. Starting with Isaac.
I would highly recommend both documentary and, you know, the biopic, because even though they both tell similar stories or similar ideas in very different ways, there is this core of, like, not just Mr. Rogers the person being in both, but like his messages and his ideals being presented, and, you know, not to be, you know, just to be very kind of calm and collected and, you know, friendly and personable. I think as someone who didn't really know about him that much until, you know, both films, I think Mr. Rogers, as, you know, the documentary, the film, and him as a person and his show is, you know, absolutely essential viewing for everybody, because even in sort of darker times, whether it be, let's say, political assassinations, even right now during the pandemic, I think people like Mr. Rogers and Mr. Rogers himself are needed more than ever. So I think there is a biasness in that, in my perception of both works. But I highly recommend it to both, because, again, they are very interesting and very thorough
in their very
different approaches. So, yeah, recommend both highly.
Joseph?
Yeah. I feel like this documentary doesn't exactly reinvent the wheel. It's quite formulaic in terms of its structure. But what it has as its core is a very important message. And it shines a light on people that should be highlighted as, you know, incredible people, national treasures to their specific countries, is an important thing. It's definitely worth checking out if you don't know much about Mr. Rogers, and because I feel like he's one of the most important people in recent, you know, history within pop culture.
Absolutely.
The film makes you want to buy a red sweater.
Yeah.
It's far from boring as well. Like, I couldn't agree more with what you guys have been saying. And it's on Netflix. So if you have a Netflix... Yes. Give it a try.
We're on campus and we're online.
We're online.
University.
Radio.
Nottingham.
We're each going to talk about a documentary that we've brought to the table. And the whole point of this episode is to introduce a little variety into people's lives. And some interesting documentaries was the entire purpose of today's show. Credit to Joseph
for
suggesting the structure.
Yeah, one thing I'll just say is that... all of these films are available on streaming, which is very important at these times.
Maradona is on four, isn't it?
It's on all four at the moment.
Yeah.
And if you have a university account, it'll be on learning on screen.
Oh, fantastic. So first, I'm going to talk about my documentary. I'll be selfish. Yeah. I'll nab the time. I think we'll have about 5 minutes each. Mm-hmm. So I am going to talk about Fyre, the greatest party that never happened. And I think this is sort of relevant to students because people would have heard about this.
Yeah, it was massive when it first came out. It was like last year, wasn't it? Beginning of last year.
So. And it's sort of like it deals with issues of influencers.
Mm.
It certainly tackles that as a concept. I'm just trying to look up, so I don't get this wrong, exactly when the Fyre Festival, quote-unquote, happened.
I think it was 2017,
yeah.
Yeah, 2017.
But I think they started promoting it latter end of 2016. So what happened is, I'll try and give you a brief overview. They took a man called Billy McFarland, not related to Seth MacFarlane, different names for one, but they do look remarkably similar. Like, I saw a promotional picture of him on, like, in the ocean. I was like, oh, my, is that Seth MacFarlane? I didn't realise he was involved in this event. So he took a bunch of people, including Ja Rule, his friend. He took Ja Rule and a bunch of models to an island, and they filmed a promotional piece for something called the Fyre Festival. They had this crazy idea. They wanted to do a big festival on an island in the middle of the Bahamas, and... You know, they wanted it to be a legendary event, and they got these like experts of the industry and these people from who knew what they were doing. Like, they brought them in and really got them hyped up, and they brought people in from Billy's company, Fyre Media, which, relevant to this, Fyre Media was based off of, they were building an app that allows people to book celebrities for events. Do you know, like, Cameo? Have you heard of Cameo?
Yeah, Cameo.
Yeah.
It's like that, but in person.
Yeah, Cameo is just, you ask a celebrity to record a message for you.
Yeah, like a happy birthday or like the introduction to something. It's like that, but an actual booking for events. So this is a man who is obsessed with celebrity and obsessed with status, and he wants the influence, and he wants to be famous, and he wants to live the dream. But most importantly, gentlemen, is that he wants to sell the dream. He wants to sell this dream of have partying on a private island. He constantly talks about the island that he built was Pablo Escobar's private island.
I was going to mention that's in the advertising. If you go on the promotional video on YouTube, it proudly presents that it was formerly Pablo Escobar's island.
But they weren't allowed to promote us that. The owner of the island said, "Don't mention Pablo Escobar at all." So they got kicked off of that island like 6 weeks before the festival, and they had to find a new location. So they chose the island of Great Exuma, which you don't have to know much about Bahamas to enjoy this roller coaster of the story. But basically, it's more of a touristy island. It's people do visit Great Exuma quite frequently. And they chose the time that they moved to Great Exuma for the time the event was supposed to be was one of the busiest weekends for the island. So there was going to be no accommodation. They'd overpromised. They'd set up so many expectations. There were so many false promises. And it basically fell apart. I'd say watch the documentary for the actual details because it's fascinating. It's an absolute roller coaster of how things can go wrong. But more than that, I'd say it's like a character study of Billy McFarland. You sort of see, he's presented at first of having reasonable intentions, maybe being a bit misleading.
Bit of a douchebag.
But yeah, a bit misleading, sorry. But you get, a bit of a, like, he wants to be like a party boy, basically. He wants to live this lifestyle, but he doesn't know the consequences. He doesn't know the first thing about event planning. He gets rid of a guy who's familiar with the Bahamas, who makes some good suggestions to him. This pilot, whose name I'm trying to find, basically says to him, Pilot Keith, who recently learned to like fly his own airplane, and he flew around the Bahamas and whatever. He made a really good suggestion of, have the festival on the island, but then have people somehow get to a cruise ship. Then everyone can stay at the cruise ship. That can be the accommodation. And then there's this really good clip where they're talking to Keith and they say to him, oh, by the way, we're not doing the cruise ship idea. And you just see his face fall. And you know he's thinking, you idiots, what are you? You have no idea what you're doing. That was before they even got kicked off of Pablo Escobar's private island. So that was before they even had the worst accommodation problems. And it's such a fascinating, like, downfall of how something started with this big idea. They had all these influencers promote it and talk about it. But none of them, basically none of the big names had actually agreed to go to the festival. There was issues booking the bands. They made promises of bands that were never going to show up and they couldn't keep. And it all falls apart. And you sort of see, at the end, you sort of see how Billy was more of a fraud, more of a fraudster, and he was actually being investigated by the FBI.
Yeah, I think I want to ask, because I haven't seen the documentary, is do they use the famous image of the cheese sandwich and salad?
Yeah, they mentioned that. They talked about
a big metaphor about the disaster, really.
30 Instagram influencers promoted the event with an orange tile as a picture on Instagram. Then one guy with a cheese sandwich tumbled the whole image of it down. It's actually brilliant. I just want to say there was a lot of jokes at the time before I move on to the next documentary. There was a lot of jokes about how, oh, it's just rich people getting, you know, getting what they deserve. Like they bought into a ridiculous event that could never happen. But because of ticket prices, there was some influencers there, but there was actually just a lot of like normal people as well who had bought reasonable tickets and they got scammed. And the workers on the island who helped set up the event on Great Exuma were never paid. So there's actually a bit more tragedy to it than just laughing at the influencers. So before we move on, what do you guys think of this concept?
Yeah.
Of the Fire Festival.
Worth checking out, yeah.
So yeah, the documentary, yeah. It's on Netflix, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's
definitely, I ain't even talked about the half of it. Because we're gonna move on. Those yeah, spoilers. Recommend go watch Fire, the greatest party that never happened. And now Isaac's gonna tell us about a documentary.
So yeah, I'm going to recommend possibly my favorite documentary of last year, which was Apollo 11. Obviously, as the title suggests, it's about the Apollo 11 mission in 1969. So it was a documentary for the 50th anniversary, and you know, it's the story of Apollo 11. You know, pretty much close to you know, the Saturn V launching, to when, you know, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins drop down into the sea after the mission is completed. But what's interesting about this documentary in comparison to, say, you know, anything you would read or see about Apollo 11 is that for the documentary they uncovered, or you know, resurfaced a lot of footage that hadn't been seen. And a lot of this footage is very high quality. It's like 70mm, so when you see it, you don't even think it's for a documentary. You think it's like, you know, outtakes for like Interstellar or something. Yeah. So when I saw this in cinemas, I felt like I was, you know, even though I was in a little, you know, relatively normal size cinema, I felt like I was in IMAX, because this footage that you see, it's like exceptional 70mm, and it's not just, oh, you know, of you know, of the launch, or it's like, it's stuff in space. It's like, it is like, it's so amazing. Just to watch this footage alone, it's just like awe-inspiring. And what I also love about the documentary is that even if you know, everyone knows what happens about Apollo 11, it's not like Apollo 13 where the mission went wrong, you know, Apollo 11 succeeded. There is still that tension of what's going to happen next. And just the way it tells the story, where it doesn't have talking heads or retrospective, you know, people talking about it, is just simply the footage, the audio of the time. And, you know, there is some, like, you know, graphics showing where the ship is in space and everything. But it is just solely about the mission. So
do you prefer it when they don't have talking heads, Isaac?
It depends. I think for something like Apollo 11, it's not fully needed, because there's already a plethora of information about Apollo 11, of course. So it's you're just there to see this amazing footage and this amazing way of telling this very well-known story. And what's kind of funny in the credits, I say this isn't I want to say this is a spoiler. It's not a plot spoiler, but it's a technical spoiler. Okay. So at the end of the documentary in the credits, both Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins are listed as cinematographers for the film because they had their own little videos and they had their own little images of, you know, in on the ship. So that's just kind of funny. So it just, it's kind of like, it makes you remember, maybe, you know, possibly nostalgically for better or worse, but like it makes you realize, especially last year, like 50 years ago, you know, we got a bunch of people and we, you know, put them in a tin can, like David Bowie said in Space Oddity, and launched them onto the moon. And there were very little problems. They did what they wanted to do on the moon. And then they came back. It's just 50 years ago, we had that technology. And it's kind of like, we don't really have that anymore, even though technology is advanced. It's a cultural thing. It's a economic thing. It's a political thing. You know, whatever you want to say why we don't do massive space missions like that anymore. It's kind of like proper time capsule of not just the mission itself, but of, you know, optimism in American culture, especially kind of maybe more, I don't know, you know, one side America, not America fully, but that kind of like, you know, the engineering side or the NASA side of America. So if you have the chance, I would, sorry if it sounds very formal, but like I really recommend watching Apollo 11, even if you know what happens, just to see this footage, like watch it in HD or watch it in 4K if you even have the chance to, because it is just, it is to me maybe the definitive document on Apollo 11.
It's certainly not something you get to see every day. Like, it's unique footage.
Yeah, I'll send you guys a link later, because
especially footage... especially if you consider that it's coming a year after First Man, which won the Academy Award for Best Visual Effects as well.
Yeah, yeah. I was surprised that Apollo 11 wasn't nominated for Best Documentary. Like, it got a BAFTA nomination for Documentary. I was shocked.
So did Diego Maradona. In yeah. BAFTA. Their BAFTA's list is a lot stronger.
Yeah.
Than the Oscars are. But that's just to do with, you know, the funding and campaigns and stuff.
I think it's also, it's kind of funny because also it wasn't made, but it was distributed by Neon, who, you know, have distributed
one Best Picture in America.
Yeah, for Parasite, but also Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which you guys know I absolutely adore. So I think it's a good, you know, show. Their films last year are really good, you know, sort of launching pad for this company, and I look forward to seeing what they distribute in the future.
Fantastic. Joseph, what do you want to talk to us about?
Yeah, I'll talk about a documentary that came out in 2016 called Supersonic. It's about the rise of Oasis between 1994, from when they weren't assigned artists, so them becoming assigned artists in 1994, to 2 years later, selling out the biggest outdoor gig of the decade.
It was two Nebworth gigs, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was like 250,000 tickets for both.
Yeah.
Oasis has to think about their whole life before going on stage.
In 1996, 2.4 million people applied for tickets in the UK. 4% of the population applied for tickets. That's how big they were.
Yeah.
It suddenly became the biggest band in the world after, with, if you just consider that they're just a bunch of kids from a council estate in Manchester. It's an incredible achievement. And basically what it does is it tells you a lot about the band, about how, you know, erratic they were, the kind of behaviour they were up to. It doesn't show them in the best light for all of it, but it's sort of like what it does so well is that it focuses mainly on the impact that the music had on the fans. Without going into detail, it's not like a fan's perspective on it, or it's just saying about how the music is the most important thing, and it's nothing special that they did on stage. They keep on saying it's about the impact that it had on everyone else.
Yeah,
how you've got all those people singing it back to you, how all the songs are known for a long time afterwards. I think it's really interesting. One of the things the Gallagher brothers say in the film about the type of music they make, because they're well known within the Britpop era, but there's a reason why their music has stood the test of time. They've done two separate styles. There's like one's about having fun, having a good time while you're young, sort of thing, one style, and then there's another one about, okay, you're feeling sad, but things are going to get better. And it's that kind of music that sort of under the test of time, and you see the difference between the process of making Definitely Maybe, their first album, and then What's the Story, Morning Glory, which became their definitive album and has been the one that stood the test of time the most.
What period and of you time can see, does it cover? Like, is it more of a
It's
slice?
Just between 94 and 96. I mean, it could have gone many different directions in the respect of, you know, a lot of things happened after 1996,
yeah.
And they left it at the, like, it's sort of like bookended by the concert. So you start at the concert and then you see how they got into that position, and then it ends with that. So like, they could have ended it there. What should have happened is that they should have just gone up in a puff of smoke and never be seen again, sort of thing, after that point. But they wanted to keep going because they felt like they could, thing, which is the obvious thing to do.
I
think, again, it's a documentary where it doesn't do the entirety of their lives and careers. It just does, you know, from their very early beginnings to those famous network gigs. And so now you have more time to focus on those few years. And it's, again, obviously, like Oasis itself, it is about the Gallagher brothers, but it does have some time to focus on the other members of the band.
Yeah, it does.
And,
you know.
And the people who helped make their albums and their songs. And I think that's also kind of important for their story.
Yeah.
Like, I think a great, like, summarization of the film is right at the beginning where it starts, where it has the footage of the network gigs. Where I think it's, I don't know which of the Gallagher brothers, but they say, I forgot what the question was, but they're saying a big question needs a big answer. And I think kind of that sets the tone of the entire film. And I think the film kind of succeeds in telling, you know, a big answer to a big question. Do you remember what the question was? Just like how they get successful, or I can't remember. But I should know. I've seen the documentary before, and someone who's not as big of an not that big of an Oasis fan, obviously Blur are the superior Britpop band.
Just gonna drop that in and walk off.
Yeah. I've seen the documentary and I think it's really good.
That's the thing, though. That's probably my only issue with them, is that I don't see how, like, people that aren't a fan of Oasis will get on with it. Like, for me, their music means a lot to me. It's music that I always go back to. Like, that era, I don't really listen to a lot, but that their music is, I feel like, is really important.
Yeah,
it touches on some very important kind of emotions.
Do you think it's definitely more for fans?
I think so, yeah. I think it's a real testament to their style. Because if you wanted to go full in depth about them, you could do, in terms of the problems and how it sort of like broke them apart. There's another documentary to be made about how Oasis didn't come to be and how Noel and Liam don't have a relationship anymore.
Yeah, you could do a whole documentary on their third album, Be Here Now, because there's so much. Like, there's a great YouTube video I watched called Train Records, where it's this guy, he does this series where he looks at albums that end careers, and he did Be Here Now, and it was just like, wow.
Todd in the Shadows.
But I feel like that would be the purpose of what this film is trying to do, which is sort of saying about, it's lightning in the bottle, this is, you know, the greatest 2 years of almost any band in history, to be honest, in terms of their sudden rise in an era that wasn't dominated by this kind of music into becoming the biggest band in the world, and them knowing it, walking the walk, talking the talk, so to speak, and just capturing the imaginations of a nation. It's very important in terms of representative of Britain in the 90s, in terms of that culture, drug culture, all these kind of things. I feel like it does very well from me learning about it, because obviously I wasn't alive in that era, so to understand how that music was created.
Yeah, and as much as I joked about Blur being the superior Britpop band, I will always admit that, like, you know, Don't Look Back on Anger is one of the greatest songs ever written.
But the thing is, what I think is great about it, that they went into full focus about my favourite Oasis song, which is, I've forgotten the name of it, Talk Tonight. And they sort of, like, they explain how Noel wrote that song, which I think, which is great for me to hear, because that's a fantastic song.
Mm. Oh, you love to hear it.
I definitely recommend checking it out if you get the opportunity, especially if you're a fan of Oasis. You know, at the very least, even if you don't get on with the content of the documentary, the soundtrack is, as you'd expect, absolutely perfect.
Yeah, agreed.
Are you going to watch it, Isaac? Have you already seen it?
Fantastic.
What I think is interesting is it does different styles of the song. So it's sort of like, some are shown the original recording of it, some are shown the live version of it, some are shown the mixed version of it. So it's not just repetitive, you're just listening to an Oasis album as it goes along. It mixes it up.
Oh, brilliant. I think we'll call it there.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for listening this week, everyone. And remember, everything we've talked about is available on demand.
Yeah. Which is good for when you can't get to the cinema.
Yeah.